Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You're listening to a talk as part of the Designing Longitudinal Research in Complex Multiprofessional Environments conference, organised by the Scottish Child Care and Protection Network. This talk was recorded on the 20th of April 2011. Paul Bradshaw, Scottish Centre for Social Research. Key issues for longitudinal research design, lessons from growing up in Scotland.
It's great to be here today and to have an opportunity to talk about some of this stuff and share our experience on the Growing Up in Scotland study, but also to share some of my knowledge through running this study about how we do it and how other people do it. And apologies to those in the audience who might have heard some of this before. You might want to go and get a coffee. Before I start, I thought it might be useful to give some suggestions about definitions of longitudinal research. Now, I mean, in the broadest sense, longitudinal research involves the follow-up of any set of entities in which changes can be observed over time. I put some examples up there. Could be individuals, could be households, could even be institutions or nations indeed. But most commonly, this sort of research is focused on individuals, and it's about creating an understanding of the development of those individuals and the change that they experience and what impact that change has on them as they move through their lives. Now, there's no recognised definition of what period or what number of follow-ups constitutes longitudinal, but, you know, we would expect you would certainly at least need to have two contacts, but usually three would be the minimum that we would think was acceptable. And as I say, normally the aim is to determine causes and processes. And in a study like Growing Up in Scotland, which is predominantly a quantitative study, we use statistical techniques to try and model behaviour or outcomes, to explore what impact particular behaviour or particular circumstances, characteristics, situations have on children's long-term outcomes. And I'm sure you'll be familiar with that approach. We're very fortunate in the UK to have a very long-standing and rich experience of longitudinal studies, particularly quantitative studies, and there are a number of ongoing internationally renowned, particularly birth cohort studies, which provide information on the life histories of people as they move from birth to old age. But the current quantitative longitudinal research being conducted in the UK covers birth cohort studies. I mean, in Scotland, we've got cohort studies that go back to the 20s, the 1920s and 1930s. There's an Aberdeen study launched in the 1950s who recently followed up their cohort using administrative linked data. There are UK-wide birth cohorts from 1946, 58, 70. The most recent one is a Millennium cohort launched in 2000. And in fact, there's funding secured for a new UK-wide birth cohort that will involve about 90,000 kids. So something on the scale we've not seen in this country before, but is undertaken on that scale in other countries, particularly European countries. Age cohort studies, now these are ones that begin at particular stages in life, and actually they tend to begin at one of two stages. They're either about adolescents or they tend to be about people who are a bit further on in life and approaching old age. So in Scotland we've got a couple of examples of these. The Scottish School Leaver study, which was run up until recently, involved adolescents and followed them as they left school. The Edinburgh study of youth transitions and crime captured kids as they entered secondary school and followed them throughout their period in secondary school and has followed them, some of them, beyond that. There's a youth cohort study in England and Wales, the longitudinal study of young people in England as well. There are longitudinal studies of ageing in most European countries, and in fact Scotland's one of the only countries that doesn't have a longitudinal study of ageing, although there has been some scoping work undertaken on that. In England, there's a very large study, the English Longitudinal Study of Ageing. The other examples we've got are panel studies. The British Household Panel study might be familiar to you. Recently, reinvented as a UK household longitudinal study, or Understanding Society, now involves 40,000 households across the UK and follows them up on an annual basis. We also had the Families and Children Study, which was a DWP-funded study that ran from about 1998 till about 2006, which followed groups of families, households over time. There are area studies as well, and there's a very famous one run in the west of Scotland, out of Glasgow, the West of Scotland 2007 study, which had three different age cohorts, and that study was completed in 2007. The area studies tend to take the form of one of the previous studies, so it's either a birth cohort or an age cohort, a panel study, but it's just focused on a single geographic area. So the Edinburgh study is also an example. It's just kids who lived in Edinburgh. We have the Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children. ALSPAC was launched in 1990s and is still running. GoWell Glasgow is a more recent example that has longitudinal elements. There's the Gateshead Millennium Study, Bourne and Bradford, Cambridge Study of Delinquent. You know, there are numerous examples of these. And of course, we have some very good examples of longitudinal studies that are constructed using census and administrative data. So the Scottish Longitudinal Study relies wholly on census and linked health data, has a sample of about 270,000 people. You may be involved, you won't know if you are. They don't know if you're involved either, they just have the data, they don't have names. There's a similar study run in England and Wales on a slightly larger scale. So we've got a really rich experience in the UK that we can draw on when we're thinking about these issues. The challenges of longitudinal research are many, but they're not challenges that can't be overcome. I put this quote up here. Binner, in a paper that they did on panels and cohort studies a couple of years ago, said that the success of a longitudinal study depends on stable leadership from a committed principal investigator and a team of highly skilled researchers. And that will certainly help. But there are several other challenges which need to be overcome in any longitudinal project if it's to succeed. Sample. This is a big one, perhaps the biggest one. And the challenges associated with the sample range from specifying your initial design through to maintaining your chosen sample throughout the life of the project. Data collection is the next one, and it offers a couple of different challenges, not all of which are unique to longitudinal research. You need to have a think about what it is you want to collect, but with longitudinal research, you also need to think about when you want to collect it, and that can be quite important. Data analysis, well, one thing that longitudinal studies are very good at is generating very large, very complex data sets, which are, as a result, very difficult to analyse, especially if you want to undertake longitudinal analysis and not something that's cross-sectional, time-specific, which is a lot more easy. Ethical considerations, so this is a sort of upshot of collecting lots of data on the same people over time. Ethical issues related to confidentiality, data security become paramount, especially if your intention is to share that data with other researchers and not to keep it to yourself. Duration, of course, by their very nature, longitudinal projects can take quite a long time to undertake, to carry out. It takes a long time for data to become available. And as such, it can be a while before results start to come through. And that can be frustrating for some people who might be involved, who might expect results more urgently, might be tempted to start producing results. And it's something we're always thinking about on GUS. So we've got 5 years' worth of data just now, 5 years of very rich data, which is great, but we're always continually thinking about, oh, imagine what we'll be able to do when we've got 6 years' worth of data, or imagine what we can do once the kids are eight and we've got details on their outcomes at that stage. Relevance, of course, this is more in relation about data use after the life of the project, because quite often what you've got is data on a very specific population at a very specific point in time, and it can quickly become irrelevant or aspects of it. And cost, as Bridget has already mentioned, these studies tend to be very expensive because you're not it's not just a single research study, it's about almost equivalent of several cross-sectional research projects. They're expensive in themselves. You're going to be running them several times. Okay, so I'm going to start by talking about the sample because I think probably, although this is an issue for any sort of research, not just longitudinal projects, it is a key issue for longitudinal projects. So I'm going to talk about sample design, and then this second issue, which is probably the most prominent, the main challenge faced by longitudinal projects. So that's about keeping a hold of your research participants as the study progresses. So I'll probably say a bit more about that than I will about design. Okay, so this next slide just throws up lots of questions, and that's largely what this presentation is about, giving you lots of questions and trying to provide some answers in relation to how we do things and growing up in Scotland. So we're talking about sample design considerations, and as I say, these are generic really for any sort of study, but worth highlighting. So the first thing we're talking about is the population of interest. Who's your research going to be about? Now, when we conduct research, we never include everybody, or we very rarely include everybody in the population of interest, and we'll normally take a sample from that population. But if you're going to take a sample, then it's importantly that you've considered very carefully what your sample is of, and you understand the limits of that sample. So if we're interested in some research on vulnerable children, we might want to sample all vulnerable children, but within that population there may be subgroups in which we're particularly interested. So we might be interested in children of a particular age. We might be interested in children who have specific family circumstances, who live in certain areas, who have been in receipt of specific services. And that is all legitimate. But what you then need to think about is whether or not those subgroups are adequately represented in any sample that you might draw from the population. And if they're not going to be adequately represented, then you need to take steps to ensure that they are by over-representing them, by boosting those groups. And in order to boost those groups, you need to be sure that you've got information about the characteristics of the sample ahead of determining that boost. So the second thing you need to think about is then what do you want to say about the sample, the people who are involved in your research? Do you want to be able to generalise your findings? If you're taking a sample of vulnerable children, do you want to conclude from your research that your findings refer to all vulnerable children? And do you want to do that with some level of confidence? And what sort of level of confidence do you want to be able to talk about your data? If you are talking about thinking about generalising, then it's important that you ensure your sample is representative of the population. And usually you can ensure this on a number of indicators, maybe age, gender, some key family characteristics, geographic area, things on which data is routinely available on your sample. And if you can ensure those characteristics match the population in your sample, then most of the time everything else will fall into place. The next bullet down is about how you're going to use the data. So you might be interested in producing estimates for the sample or for the population as a whole. So you might just want to say X percent of children had outcome Y. But more likely, what you will be interested in doing is comparing the outcomes of children with different circumstances or characteristics. So outcomes for children in the different subgroups, for example. But to do that, it's necessary to ensure that there are enough children in each of those subgroups to make a statistically robust comparison. So again, it's important that you're defining those subgroups in advance to make sure when you come to analyse your data that your numbers are large enough to make those comparisons. And the next step, so you've defined your population of interest, you know what you want to say about them, but how are you actually going to find them? How are you going to recruit them? How are you going to invite them to participate in your research? Now, decisions on the population of interest, in fact, and whether you're going to boost subgroups depends on what information sources or sampling frames are available, which contain the sorts of detail about the children in which you're interested. So, for example, on Grown Up in Scotland, we sample from the child benefit records. And we use that because it's a universal benefit currently. All children, all families in the UK with children under 18 or under 16, unless they're in full-time education, are eligible. It has a very high uptake. It's about 97% of those people who are eligible for child benefit take it up. The HMRC who administer the sample can provide us with address details and postcodes so we can match in area deprivation and we can use that in our sampling frame. They can tell us information about the gender of the children in the household. They can tell us information about the age of the person receiving the benefits, so maternal age if we want to have a think about that, the number of children in the household and the age of the other children in the household. So for a general population study like GUS, that sampling frame is ideal. So because it gives us the information that we need in advance of extracting our sample, and we know we can use it for that. But something else to consider is whether or not the sampling frame you're thinking about using actively excludes any children that you may be interested in, either because they'll not appear on the sampling frame or because whoever holds that sampling frame will not release that data to you. So on child benefit, we have those challenges. So children who are in the care of the local authority, looked after away from home, do not appear on child benefit registers. So they are not included in our sampling frame. So you can scratch that one to begin with. And the other thing is that HMRC will remove families who have been sampled for research in the last 3 years. So they'll be excluded from the research. That's not a particular concern. They'll probably not have any particular characteristics. But they'll also remove families in which they are in correspondence, with whom they're in correspondence with. And that can be related to a child death, it can be related to a parental separation, a host of things. And some of those families might be of interest to us in our research, but they only represent a very small proportion of the excluded cases, so don't cause us a great deal of concern. But then you've got to think about recruitment. How are you going to recruit your sample? Are you going to send them a letter and invite them to participate? Are you going to do it face-to-face? If you're doing it face-to-face, are you having to rely on some service or agency to recruit on your behalf? So a lot of birth cohort studies, not particularly in the UK, but elsewhere, use midwives to recruit, for example. If we are talking about recruiting a sample of vulnerable children or looked after children, we might be thinking about having social workers recruit on our behalf. So there's some challenges associated with that. The type of recruitment that you take will determine your response rate. You know, if you send people a letter and ask them to participate, if it's an opt-in, they probably won't write back and say, yes, please include me in your research, I'm very interested in it. Those who do that will have particular characteristics, and so opt-in, generally speaking, will put you at a bias to begin with. Opt-out is more appealing, but again, there'll still be groups of people who will not participate. And so there needs to be some thought about how you're going to recruitment, how you're going to sell the research to them. We'll come on to some of that in a minute. And also recruitment and the opt-in, opt-out is a key issue for ethics. And we have continual difficulties in convincing ethics committees about the value and the need for opt-out in studies of this nature as opposed to opt-in. Okay, so sampling precision. I'm only going to speak about this very briefly. I'm not a statistician. This is just an overview of some of the things that you need to consider. If you're using a sample, the data that you have will only ever produce estimates of what the real value might be in the population. Okay, so if you say 67% of children looked after at home get three or more standard grades, you are estimating, it's probably higher than that, that's just off the top of my head, you're only estimating what the true value might be. How confident you are in that estimate is determined by the size of your sample and whether or not it's clustered. Now, clustering is an issue for us as a large research organisation. Lots of our samples are clustered that can affect. We measure sample precision using confidence intervals and standard errors. Now, confidence intervals are those things that you'll see when you read a research paper and it will say we are confident at the 95% level, at the level of 95% level of confidence. That just means that 95 times out of 100, the interval, the confidence interval, will capture the true population value that you're trying to estimate. You could be 95% confident that you've captured the right value. These confidence intervals are usually expressed as a plus or minus followed by a value. So 64% I've put up there, plus or minus 6%. Now that suggests that your true value is somewhere between 58 and 70. Now any differences that you want to demonstrate between your subgroups, for example, will then need to be approximately about the magnitude of that confidence interval for them to be statistically significant. So if you are comparing, if you've got an estimate of 64% in one subgroup and another estimate of 60% in another subgroup, with that confidence interval, it's probably not going to be statistically significant. If it's 58%, it probably will be, but only just. Smaller sample sizes produce larger confidence intervals, which means you need to have bigger change to demonstrate statistically significant differences. If you've got a small sample size and it's only a small change between your subgroups, it will probably not be significant. So you need to bear that in mind. So what sorts of sample sizes are necessary to detect statistically significant differences? I'm going to stop talking about statistics in a minute, so don't worry. Well, that sort of depends on the prevalence of the characteristic that you're measuring and the size of the difference between the groups that you want to detect. So, for illustrative purposes, let's say that 75% of children who are looked after at home get three or more passes at standard grade level. We might want to compare this pass rate with some other subgroup of interest, for example, children who are looked after away from home. In order to detect a difference of 10 percentage points, so 65 going down to 65 or going up to 85%, with a power of 0.8, you'll need a sample size of about 260 in each group in order for that to be a statistically significant difference. Now, a power of 0.8 just means that if we repeated the survey lots of times, we would expect to observe a significant difference at the 95% level in 80% of those surveys. Okay, and that's generally considered to be acceptable for most projects. If your estimate is closer to 50%, so around about the middle of the range, as opposed to 75%, then you'll need a sample of about 390. So, as your differences get smaller, your sample sizes get bigger. And as your estimates get closer to the middle, your sample sizes need to be bigger. So, this is an issue for any quantitative study, not just for longitudinal research. The issue about longitudinal research is that you need these sample sizes to be that size at the point you're measuring the outcomes. That might be 15 years down the line. So you're going to have to start with sample sizes considerably higher than that to allow for non-response in nutrition. That's the key. How do we get on with this in GUS? Okay, so I've got a table up here showing some of the data that we have on response rates on gas over the first four sweeps. I've got two percentages up there. So the first percentage, the response rate, is the number of achieved interviews as a percentage of those interviews that we had a chance of achieving at each wave. So proportion achieved of the number issued. The second percentage measures sample attrition or retention, so how good we were at keeping a hold of people over time. And what the second figure shows is that by the fourth wave, we'd lost about 23% of our families in both cohorts, and that's with an annual follow-up. Now, this attrition can affect your sample in two ways. It reduces the overall sample size here, but it can also have a disproportionate effect on particular subgroups. So on GUS, like on any other survey, we find significantly lower response rates amongst more disadvantaged groups, you can see in this graph, which is maternal age. So we get a much lower response rate amongst younger mothers than we do amongst older mothers. And younger mothers are a particular group of interest for us because they represent all other a whole range of additional disadvantaged characteristics. So because of the way non-response affects the precision of survey estimates, it's a concern to all survey managers, not just when you're working on longitudinal research, but the combined issues of non-response and attrition over time are of particular significance in longitudinal research. I mean, if you're getting a low response rate on a cross-sectional survey, in theory, you can just keep issuing cases until you get large enough numbers in your achieved sample to do the analysis. You can't do that in longitudinal research. And you could do it at your first wave, sure. But if you're following up, you can't. There's no point in issuing new sample because you don't have that first set of data. Now, some studies do it, and there are legitimate reasons why you might be interested in refreshing, what we call refreshing your sample at a later wave. But ultimately, it means you've missed a stage of data collection earlier on. So sample maintenance for longitudinal studies is a key issue, if not the key issue for any longitudinal project. So when we're designing GUS and on an ongoing basis, we had and have to think about effective strategies for keeping respondent details up to date so that we can find them when we go out to speak to them, but also for keeping people interested in the study so that they will continue to participate as we continue. So let's take a look at how successful we've been at this so far. So these are percentages for what we call non-contact and refusal. And the non-contact is just the proportion of cases where we issue them to field, the interviewer goes out, but we can't find them. Okay, they've moved and we don't have a follow-up address. We can't determine whether or not they live at the address, which happens in a small proportion of cases. So the interviewer turns up, somebody answers the door, but they're not prepared to tell us whether or not the person we're looking for lives there. And so there's some confusion about these cases. What you can see is that we're a bit better at one than the other. So we have very few problems on GUS with finding people, and that is generally the experience for most longitudinal studies, because so much data is collected on people these days that it's usually possible to find them, and there are well-proven techniques that can help you keep in touch with your sample members. Our refusal rate is a little higher. Each sweep, about 5 or 6% of the cohort tell us they don't want to take part. This is pretty small when compared to most cross-sectional surveys, but it's about average for a cohort study of this nature. And actually, some of those people have refused just for a single sweep. So we've turned up and they said, we don't want to take part this year, and we reissue them the following year, and we bring them back into the study, which helps us maintain our numbers. So whilst the proportions are pretty small, the loss of any sample members is problematic, and it's important to have strategies in place to keep address and contact details accurate and to ensure that people participate in the study over the long term. So how do we go about this? This next slide just summarises some of the key issues and strategies associated with sample maintenance on a longitudinal study. So we've got keeping in touch. We need to keep in regular contact with the families involved. We have tracing mechanisms which kick in whenever we discover that a family has moved and we don't know where they've gone. We've got to keep respondents updated about what the study's doing and how their data is being used. Make sure that they're valued and appreciated, including but not restricted to the use of incentives. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. As I mentioned already, you can boost your key subgroups of interest either at the start to ensure your numbers are higher if you expect higher attrition amongst those groups, but you can refresh your sample on an ongoing basis if that will not limit the types of analysis that you're planning on doing. And making reasonable demands. It's about minimising burden for those people who are involved in your projects. So keeping in touch. Some people will, who are potentially willing will be lost by virtue of moving home. So there are a couple of techniques that we've got which allow us to try and keep in touch with as many people as possible. So at any contact, we collect as much contact information as possible, telephone numbers, mobile numbers, email addresses, any potential way of contacting these people. We will also record details about the previous interview. So when we issue a case in a future suite, the interviewer who's turning up will know the day of the week that the last interview was conducted, the time. They will know information about, you know, when it's a good time to call, whether the people work night shift, which door it is in the street, if there's a particular way in, if they prefer to be phoned in advance, whether the granny lives up the road. Lots of these small bits of detail that makes it easier to keep in touch and to get hold of people. Stable contacts are very familiar in non-longitudinal research. A stable contact is just someone familiar to the person that you're interested in who is likely to know where they have moved to if they move. So in GUS, for example, we normally end up getting a grandparent of the child. It's increasingly common for longitudinal studies to collect multiple stable contacts. And we find this to be very effective as a strategy to find out where people have moved to. We send regular and advanced mailings to the people in our cohort. So on GUS, ahead of any wave going into field, we'll send what we call a pre-advance letter. It goes out about 2 months in advance of field work. If that's returned to us undelivered, then it gives us a period in which we can undertake tracing in the office before the case is issued to field so that when the interviewer eventually receives the data, then the contact information is more accurate. And that in-office tracing will consist of using the stable contact information or using mobile numbers, email addresses, any data that we've got to try and get hold of people. Some studies, like Centre for Longitudinal Studies, who run the Millennium Cohort and some of the big cohort studies, use tracing software, which draws on information from credit checks, Experian, electoral rolls. It rolls it all up in a big database and you can search them, you pay a fee, and they can be very useful as well. We also send out newsletters, thank you letters, advance letters, Christmas cards, mailings on a fairly regular basis, and anything that comes back undelivered gets immediately traced. So it's all about keeping in regular contact. Your sampling frame can be used as a source of contact information. So, for example, on GUS, we sampled from child benefits. Initially, for the first few waves, DWP or HMRC provided us with address updates for anybody on their system who had moved, that they had logged, was involved in the process. So if you are making considerable use of linked data, sometimes, given the correct approval, you can use those administrative databases to find out updated or refreshed contact details. And a lot of longitudinal studies do that, not particularly in the UK, but it's very common in Europe for this linked administrative data to be used to follow where people and find out where people have gone. So keeping respondents informed. It's important in any research project to give good information about the purpose and nature of the research. They've also got to understand the longitudinal nature of the study. A lot of longitudinal studies adopt a branding approach. A name and a logo clearly identifies the study. It's easily recognisable by respondents. Websites are great. They can provide respondents with lots of information in an accessible format if they want to find out more, as well as providing contact details should they need to get in touch. This is some of the branding that we use on GUS. It's our GUS logo. It goes on everything that we issue to respondents. It goes on our Christmas cards, our advanced leaflets. We've issued respondents with pens, fridge magnets, calendars, colouring in books, all with this logo, and most of which have a contact number for the research team to act as reminders that they're involved. Please contact us if you move, things like that. It's familiar, as I said. This is some examples from Growing Up in Ireland, which a cohort study launched a couple of years ago. All very bright and inviting and appealing. This is an example of the website from ALSPAC, the Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children. Most of these websites have a section for participants, those people who are involved in research. In this case, these kids are now adolescents, well, they're now in their 20s. Some studies go in for this in a big way. This is a screenshot, and I had thought about showing you an example. This is from the Danish National Birth Cohort, and it's a website that's designed for the kids who are involved in that cohort who are age 11. And you can click on all of these wee things, and wee interactive videos pop up, tell them information. They can do wee quizzes. You know, a lot of studies invest a lot of time and effort into making people feel they're really valued and letting people understand what it is that they're taking part in. So valuing and appreciating respondents. Well, thank you letters are fairly standard on most surveys, and we use them certainly on GUS. Providing evidence illustrating the impact. So we send an annual newsletter to our respondents that tells them about the latest findings, tells them how Scottish Government are using the findings to influence policy, to influence change for children and families. Incentives are not actually very common yet in longitudinal research of this nature in the UK. But they are becoming more so in light of falling response rates across the board. We don't issue the incentives at all on GUS, and what we'll give people is a notepad to say thanks very much, or a pen as a sort of, it's not even a reward really, it's just a sort of, you know, here's a token of our appreciation. And usually we find that is sufficient, and we don't. However, given the attrition and non-response amongst certain key subgroups, there are some arguments, perhaps, for introducing incentives. Not necessarily for all of your sample, but maybe for some of your sample. And certainly for a very hard-to-reach group, incentives might be something you'll need to be thinking about from the start. Of course, with a longitudinal study, you can add a temporal aspect to your incentives. So some studies give you more with each contact as an incentive. So if you take part this sweep, you will get this. If you take part at the next sweep as well, you'll get double the amount, triple the amount. It can work like that as well. So there's some things that you can think about there. You know, some of the very long established studies have really got this sorted. I've got some two slides here that show some examples, some excerpts from research done by the National Child Development Study. This is a 58 cohort, and they had their 50th anniversary in 2008. And they did some qualitative research with their cohort members, and some of that was about how they felt about being involved in a research of this nature. And you know, this one is quite nice because it says, there's one thing I'm guaranteed all of my entire life is one birthday card. You know, because they get a birthday card from the study every year. But also, clearly they've had an impact in making people understand how important it is that this research is that they're involved in. So, really interesting, you don't get this very often. These people have been involved for 50 years, since they were babies. But they definitely recognise the value. Okay, so data collection is the next thing. What to ask and when. The decisions about this require good planning. It's important on a longitudinal research project to ask the right questions at the right time. So you're going to have to take a longitudinal view. And the core concern with this type of research is that you get to outcome stage and you find that you haven't collected the right information at the previous stages. So how can you avoid this? Well, you need to make sure you have a really thorough planning process, planning out the whole data collection process before you start. And you need to be aware of the full duration of the project. But you also need to be aware of what you're going to be interested at the end. What ultimately are you measuring as outcomes? And what do you expect at these earlier stages to influence those outcomes? And so you need, that will influence what you're measuring from the start. What if you miss something? Well, you'll almost always discover something that you wish you had measured at an earlier stage. And if you do, what can you do about it? Well, it depends what stage you're at. If you still get further follow-ups, you can always collect that data retrospective. There'll be some issues about recall that you might have to come about, but ultimately, if you're coming back to them, you can always fill those gaps. Some of those gaps might be filled by administrative data as well, which can be extremely useful in terms of minimising burden if you've got a face-to-face research contact as well. What about intervals between fieldwork, which is something that's considered and varies considerably? How often are you going to follow up your sample? Now, this is kind of dependent upon respondent burden, the developmental stages that you're interested in, whether there are particular processes, transition points that you're interested in, that you want to capture some data at. But ultimately, the major factor is budget, because budget will determine how many times you can come back to people. There's actually no recognised or legitimate pattern. It's always dependent on the objectives and the focus of the research, just to demonstrate that. This table illustrates the contact points of the main, some of the main cohort studies running in the UK currently over the first 16 years. And you can see that there's considerable variation in the points that they follow up. MCS does it about every 2 years. GUS, we did it annually initially. ALSPACT have done it every year. And in fact, in this period, there are about four or five contacts from conception through to birth as well. So a whole range of patterns. If you're relying heavily on routine data, some of that will be determined. So, you know, if you're going to routine administrative health data collected by health visitors, that will be at 6 to 8 weeks. It will be at 30 months. It will then be at preschool. So some of that's determined already. What do we collect on GUS? This gives you just a very brief overview of some of the different sources of data. Just conscious of time. Our main source of information is a 60-minute face-to-face interview with the child's main carer. We supplemented that at various points, partners' interviews. We take child height and weights. We've measured child cognitive ability. We've collected consent to link to health records, which will give us retrospective access back to birth and conception for the mother and the child. And we've recently collected consent for access to school records, which will give us a range of information on the school itself and different issues, individual information about the child. Excuse me. Okay, so we've got all this data, reams and reams of it. What are we going to do with it? Just a very quick look at some issues related to data analysis. It's important to recognise the benefits of longitudinal data. It measures change over time. So you capture flows into and out of states, so like poverty, unemployment, being looked after might be something that we are interested in this project. You can then consider using that data the effects of change on outcomes, the effect of how long children are in particular states on outcomes. You can look at impact of interventions and you can consider issues of individual development. You've got the temporal ordering of events. It gives you a better opportunity to look at cause and effect. It won't necessarily allow you to determine cause and effect, but it's certainly easier to do it with longitudinal data. There's improved control over cross-sectional data. You know, it has a lot of statistical benefits. You can also look at the effects of ageing itself. If you've got multiple cohorts, then cohort membership as well. Drawbacks, of course, data management is a key one. You will generate a data set that has very complex structures, complex relations, particularly if you've got multiple sources of data, if you've got interview data combined with administrative data, especially if it's administrative data from multiple sources. How are you going to link that all together and ensure that you've got everything in the right order? You'll have complex variables and samples. You will be repeating measures over time, so you need to make sure you're defining some way that you can label your variables, that you can recognise when, what they collect and when they were collected. So your file and variable management requires training and skills of good practice, but there are a lot of people out there who are capable of that. You've also got some software issues. Longitudinal analysis, where you are building in duration and time, consideration of time, can be quite complex, and only certain software applications will allow you to do that sort of analysis. And these are the sorts of things that you can do. Event history analysis is a common one where your time is continuous and usually you're modelling the probability of an event occurring given that it's not occurred already. Or you might be modelling the characteristics which affect the duration of an event or the duration of a state. And there's also panel data, the particular regression models available for repeated observations, etc., etc. So some specific techniques, but they can require some specialist knowledge and your data to be in a specific setup to undertake them. Okay, last couple of slides now. Ethical issues. Confidentiality, data security, data access are all very big issues. For any sort of research, we've had a lot of high-profile data incidents recently. Respondents, potential respondents, are becoming more wary of how their data is stored, who has access, how it will be used. So it's critical that respondent confidentiality is maintained. The issue with longitudinal research is that you have reams of data, multiple sets of data on single people, on individual people, which makes the risk of identification greater. But in order to take full advantage of the greater analytical potential of longitudinal data, you need to make it more available to more people so that they can take advantage of the richness. There are a couple of options. You can restrict the data that's released. You can anonymise it, remove identifying variables. These might be socioeconomic. It kind of depends on your sample frame, your research design, things like that, the characteristics of the population. Data security is becoming important. This will have been considered in depth at the last seminar, I'm sure. But you can have secure locations for sensitive data. Increasingly, sensitive data can be hosted online and only accessed online. Some organisations have secure terminals that you can come in and analyse more risky data. But it's important that you've appropriate controls. And consent is another issue, and a particular issue about longitudinal research, because what you have is a situation where you need to maintain informed consent as the study progresses. I mean, it's accepted practice to provide potential subjects with information on the research in advance of the participation. But for this sort of research, it's important that they understand that the project is longitudinal in nature, so that you're going to be expecting their involvement over a period of time, that they're able to withdraw from the project whenever they want, and that's crucial. And it's generally good practice to provide contact details for the research team on all communications, so that they can get in touch if they want to find out more. One offer, repeated consent, I've got up there. There's no universal practice in this respect. Some studies are required by their ethics committee to have a consent form signed at every contact, ahead of every contact. On GUS, we ask people to sign a consent form at the start, and at the end of every interview, we ask for their permission to come back to them the following year. And that's a basic requirement. And anybody who says they don't want us to come back, we don't go back. So some worth bearing in mind. Okay, just to finish. Slightly over time, sorry about that. longitudinal research in any methodological discipline presents a set of core challenges, and really the key issue is to consider in detail how this fundamental temporal nature of the project affects the basic aspects of its design. So it affects the sample, it affects how it affects the data collection, how it affects the data analysis, how it affects your issues about ethics. These studies require a more complex design, but it's not a design that is impossible to achieve, and a good design will produce tremendously valuable data. Thank you very much.
This recording is copyright of IRIS 2011. It may be reused in the terms of Creative Commons licences, attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 2.5 UK Scotland licence. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.